Governor Rauner this weekend traveled to Rome to celebrate with the newly elevated Cardinal Supich. We talk about his trip and the politics of what's happening back in Springfield with state lawmakers. But first, there are more bacteria cells in and on your body than there are human cells, and those bacteria play an important role in our health.
You see, a microbiome is like a whole rainforest in a drop of water. We are now discovering that our planet, our health, and perhaps even our happiness depend upon them.
That's Argonne National Labs' Jack Gilbert. How much are we messing with our natural ecosystems by overusing antibiotics? We'll speak with him and the Illinois Department of Public Health Director, Dr. Nirav Shah, about the importance of the dangers of misusing antibiotics and the overall importance of gut health. They'll take your questions, too. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455 or tweet to 21st Show. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Think about this. There are 40 trillion bacteria cells living in and on you right now. That's more than the number of human cells you're made of. That's about 35 trillion. While bacteria often get a bad rap, the bacteria that we coexist with play important roles, helping digest our food, stimulating our immune system, even helping to protect us from illnesses. Knowing that, it should come as no surprise that protecting our gut health has important implications for our overall health, and that altering any bacteria in our body without reason can be problematic. One way we do that, by taking antibiotics. Of course, antibiotics can be life-saving, but if they're taken when they're not needed, that's bad news, not just for individuals, but also from a public health standpoint. That's what we're going to be talking about this hour on the 21st. If you have questions or comments for our guests, as always, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21st Show. Joining us to talk about this is Dr. Nirav Shah. He's the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Dr. Shah, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely, Niall. It's great to be with you.
Can you explain, first of all, just for us, how antibiotics work? Do they literally, when you're taking them, do they wipe out all the bacteria, the good and bad that you have?
You know, it depends on the kind of antibiotic that you're taking. There are, generally speaking, two types of antibiotics. The first are what are called wide-spectrum antibiotics, and as their name implies, they are like a big gun that just takes out every kind of bacteria in their line of sight. The other kind of antibiotics are the narrow-spectrum antibiotics, and those are ones that are engineered to just focus on particular bugs. Physicians are trained in which type to administer to which kind of patient, and it really depends on the clinical scenario. That's what governs what sort of antibiotic someone is given.
Yeah, and I know that we're going to be talking about ways that antibiotics are being misused. Do you feel like we're getting to a better understanding, both from a clinical perspective as well as patient education, about understanding when and what type of antibiotics should be used?
Well, since the problem of antibiotic resistance really came onto the scene a number of decades ago, there have been tremendous strides in educating physicians as well as patients on the proper use and stewardship of those antibiotics. There are some glimmers of hope on the horizon. The rates of inappropriate antibiotic prescribing in outpatient settings or even in hospitals have stabilized or gone down, but there is still a lot of work that remains. And that's why this issue is one of the top priorities here at the Illinois Department of Public Health.
That's Dr. Nirav Shah. He's the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. You know, when you say that, I mentioned there's a study that we saw earlier this year that found that nearly one in three antibiotics prescribed in the U.S. today are unnecessary. So one in three sounds like a lot. How is this happening?
Well, in some cases, Nyla, even in the outpatient setting, for example, it could be up to half of the antibiotics that are prescribed are unnecessary.
Wow.
This occurs for an insidious set of reasons. Really, it comes down to a couple of things. The first is that prescribing antibiotics is easy. In some cases, it's difficult for a physician to know, for example, whether your cough is related to a virus, which doesn't need an antibiotic, or a bacteria, which might require one. But sometimes the diagnostic equipment, the tests that are needed to figure that out, are either unavailable or may take a couple days to get back in. So there's incentives on the physician side to sometimes prescribe the antibiotic, but there are also incentives on the patient side to demand antibiotics. For various anthropological or sociological reasons, a lot of folks feel like if they go to the doctor with a cough and they don't get a pill, they haven't gotten their money's worth. All of these things speak to the need for education, both on the provider side as well as on the patient side. One of the initiatives that we've been working on is a campaign to work with physicians to give them the tools they need to explain to patients why antibiotics are not always the right choice.
This is Dr. Nirav Shah. He's a director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. I want to bring someone else into this conversation as well. Jack Gilbert is the group leader for microbial ecology at Argonne National Labs. He also teaches at the University of Chicago. Jack, Professor Gilbert, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, nice to be here.
So I wonder if you can, we're talking about antibiotics and bacteria. I wonder if you can help us explain a little bit of your research. You work on the whole notion of a microbiome. Can you first even explain what a microbiome is?
Yeah, so a microbiome is a collection of bacteria, fungi, viruses, all intermingled and interacting together in an environment. We might consider that environment an ocean or a lake or a river or a plant or the human intestine. They're all just ecosystems to us. And so what we're really interested in understanding with antibiotics is to determine how those antibiotics disrupt that ecosystem, right? Exactly the same as if you cut down a forest to disrupt an ecosystem, an antibiotic has an impact upon the ecosystem of your gut. And we're only really just starting to understand the potential impacts that an antibiotic can have upon your overall system health.
Yeah, and what are those impacts? I mean, if you're talking about, as you said, cutting down a whole forest to further your analogy, what is the result of that?
Yeah, well, okay, so it depends upon the time of life that you have that antibiotic. So we know, we have a lot of evidence from working with children that antibiotics taken very early in life can have potentially have negative consequences for their development, both the neurological development, but also obesity and various allergy states such as food allergies or asthma. There are these conditions can actually be have a heightened risk of happening if you've had an antibiotic within the first year of life. And the number of antibiotic doses you get actually scales very well with the increase in risk for, say, developing obesity or developing an asthma attack. So we've started to see that the disruption of the microbiome early in life can have potential implications upon those diseases. That's not to say that you shouldn't take those antibiotics, but you should be very, very aware of the risks of taking them. And bear in mind, everybody that takes an antibiotic doesn't become obese and doesn't develop neurological problems and doesn't don't develop asthma or food allergies, but there's a heightened risk of developing those. And we're only just, as scientists, starting to understand how all of those things interact.
And Jack, when you say that, and when you say, especially when you're thinking about children, I'm sure parents that are listening are thinking, okay, so you've kind of laid out if a child has any antibiotic within its first year. But when you say how much antibiotics is too much, do we even know that yet for children?
We have no idea. And, you know, I'm a father. I have two sons, 9 and 7. And my 7-year-old just, had bronchitis, and I went to my doctor. He had a persistent cough, and it had been lasting for more than 4 weeks. So I went to my doctor, and I said to her, I'm a scientist. I almost preach the gospel according to control in antibiotics. So I need to be very, very sure if you are sure that my son needs an antibiotic to treat this bronchitis. And she says, look, it's extremely likely it's bacterial. Right, and he has all of these symptoms and signals of a bacterial bronchial infection, not a viral one. So, she said she would preach control of antibiotics to the nines, but she suggests very carefully in this time that it would be dangerous not to take the antibiotic. So, in my mind, we have to have those very frank conversations with our physicians and say, look, how sure are you that I need this antibiotic, or how sure are you that my child needs this antibiotic? And if they say to you, look, in my professional opinion, your child should take this antibiotic, it outweighs any potential risks, then you should definitely take that antibiotic.
Yeah. So, Dr. Shaw, as we're hearing Jack share the story of how he interacted with his family's pediatrician, do you feel like we need to be doing more education on the patient side as well? Our parents, especially when we're talking about children, do you think that parents are having sufficient enough conversations with their pediatricians about antibiotic use? What would you like to see happen?
Well, Professor Gilbert is right. We really need to encourage everyone to have that exact conversation with their healthcare provider. And the question, as he framed it, is exactly right. We are used to thinking about drugs in terms of side effects. And we all think about that. Do I really need to take this? What are the effects on my liver if I take this drug? Well, antibiotics are no different. Antibiotics have side effects. But one of the side effects that we are just now really starting to appreciate with the discussions around resistance is not the side effects to me personally, but the side effect to society.
Mm-hmm.
And getting folks, getting patients to really think about these external side effects of drugs like antibiotics, it's a challenge. But one of the ways that we can get to that is by starting to work with folks and patient groups to normalize the idea that an antibiotic is not the standard. To get folks comfortable with the fact that you might go to the doctor, the doctor might give you a thorough examination and ultimately conclude that what's causing your cough is actually just a virus. And then everyone being okay with you getting the medical advice that your grandmother probably gave, which is going home, getting a lot of fluids and getting a lot of rest, and then being okay in a couple days. Getting to that place of thinking that that was a great clinical encounter takes work. But that's one of the messages and one of the reasons that we're delighted to be on the air with you today.
Mm-hmm. Jack, even with all of your research and expertise, did you find, I'm just curious, was it hard for you to push back with your doctor to question that recommendation? I know I always say, I have this conversation, I think, with every, and Dr. Shaw, I had shared this with you at one point when we were talking about doing this segment. I had a whole conversation with a doctor a couple weeks ago where I just said, she prescribed antibiotics and I said, I don't want those. Do you think I really need to have them? Was it, Jack, did you feel like this is something where probably, I don't know if the pediatrician already knows what you do anyway, but was it hard for you to push back with your doctor?
I was nervous about doing it, absolutely. And that's, it seems funny coming from somebody who works in this field. But I don't want to appear to be overbearing to the pediatrician in question. So I didn't want to go in and say, look, I don't want to be militant about this. That antibiotics could disrupt my child's ecosystem and it could have negative consequences or could lead to increased antibiotic resistance. But I was very lucky in the fact that she was already quite well versed in this. And I'm sure many of the listeners on this show will have had experiences where their doctors are less educated as to the potential risks and are like, well, look, I don't care. I want to make sure that I give you this dose because the potential complications from not taking it severely outweigh any potential complications from taking it. This is a conversation that we need to be very careful about having. One of the great examples is otitis media, so having an ear infection. We regularly provide antibiotics for the treatment of ear infections in children, with very little evidence from double-blind trials, placebo-controlled trials, that the application of antibiotics significantly decreases the amount of time the children will suffer from that disease. So invariably, a child will get over otitis media very, very quickly. And there's a very, very, very small number of those children that will go on to suffer from a severe complication. And so we have to have a very frank discussion about risks and probabilities. And that is extremely difficult to have that conversation with the vast majority of the public. We've seen this problem with vaccines, for example. When you start talking about risks and probabilities, people will say, well, I don't want to be the risk factor.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Go on.
No, well, I was just going to say, well, when you say that, the risk factor, and we've seen this also with vaccines, and Dr. Shaw, you alluded to this, we've seen superbug problems. I wanted to ask you, Dr. Shaw, about, there was a study out last week from Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, finding that highly drug-resistant infections are rising among children. How extensive is this problem, particularly if we just want to focus on children right now and antibiotic-resistant bugs that we're seeing?
The problem is unfortunately very extensive, and it's one that's growing. The likelihood of a child coming down with a drug-resistant infection is growing with each passing year. And the problem there is that the magnitude of harm from having a resistant infection itself grows with each passing year. Nationwide, not just specific to children, but nationwide, in the United States, there are over 2 million infections each year that are associated with antibiotic-resistant bugs. That translates into about 23,000 deaths for both adults and children across the country. Unfortunately, as the resistance...
Is that every year, 23,000 deaths?
That is correct. Every year, about approximately 23,000 deaths are associated with antibiotic-resistant bugs. And this is a problem that's going to grow every passing year. Now, not every condition... not every clinical condition has a problem with antibiotic resistance, but virtually all of them do. Some of the biggest concerns right now are with respect to things like garden variety pneumonia. Pneumonia 100 years ago was uniformly fatal, or very, very highly fatal. And if the resistance rates continue to keep creeping up, we could in the near future also find ourselves in an era where even routine clinical conditions like pneumonia, childbirth, or surgery could once again be life-threatening.
We're going to take a break. When we come back with, we're going to just take a break, Jack. I know you can weigh in when we come back. We'll continue this conversation with Jack Gilbert, Argonne National Labs, Jack Gilbert, and the Illinois Department of Public Health, Dr. Nirav Shah. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about antibiotics and more specifically about the ways that antibiotics can be misused, what the implications are, not just for individual health, but for public health overall. My guests are the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health, Dr. Nirav Shah, and Professor Jack Gilbert, who teaches at the University of Chicago. He's also the group leader for microbial ecology at Argonne National Labs. Just before the break, we were talking about superbugs. And Dr. Shah, I just wanted to ask you about most recent news we've heard in terms of antibiotic resistance or superbugs, is we saw some news in Illinois with two incidents in September. There were two high school student athletes in Naperville who were treated for MRSA. And I wanted to ask you about how the Illinois Department of Public Health is tracking superbugs and how you're sort of dealing with that, even in how you're working to educate hospitals on dealing with this.
So I'll take both of those questions. In terms of tracking these, we work very closely not just with local hospitals, but also with a network of laboratories around the region, as well as with some of the laboratories at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. When specimens that are submitted to us, so when a hospital thinks that it might have a very highly resistant type of bug on its hands, it can send those specimens to us, and we work very closely with the CDC to really get the exact fingerprint of those bugs. The reason that's important is so that we can track the emergence and the travel of these bugs, not just around the region or around the country, but really around the globe. We live in an era, as everyone knows now, where an antibiotic-resistant bug can pop up in Western China, but only be a few plane flights away from the city of Chicago. So getting the exact fingerprint, the DNA fingerprint of these bugs is really important. And that's one of the things that we at the department work with our colleagues at the national level to do. But as you noted, Nyla, educating hospitals and the clinicians who practice in hospitals is critical here. We have a campaign that we've started that works with hospitals as well as outpatient providers to educate them on the best stewardship principles. It's called Precious Drugs and Scary Bugs. And we work with physicians at all levels of practice to make sure that they have the most up-to-date information about antibiotic resistance so that they know what types of conditions are amenable to antibiotics and which ones, more importantly, are not. For example, the common cold or the common flu is not something that an antibiotic will help with. But the most important thing we do is help give them the communication tools that allow them to speak with patients and explain to them in a way that everyone will understand and appreciate why an antibiotic might not be the right choice for them.
Mm-hmm. And as we're thinking about this, and we're thinking not just about antibiotics, but other medications, Professor Gilbert, a couple years ago, President Obama launched the Precision Medicine Initiative, the central idea being that every person is unique. So doctors need to be thinking about treating each patient as a unique individual, whether that's looking at everyone's unique genetic composition, as well as you've said that in the field of precision medicine, they also need to have a greater focus on our microbiome and our bacteria. Why do you think that's an important interaction as well?
We all have a unique microbiome. So, you know, I can genetically identify individuals based on the genetic composition of their bacterium, not just their genome of their own DNA. So we know that each person has a unique microbiome, and that unique microbiome can influence how they respond to drugs, how they respond to therapies. We're able to sometimes stratify or identify patients that are going to respond really well to a treatment based on their microbial community in their stool, for example, or in their oral cavity. And so there is further increasing and very compelling evidence that monitoring their microbiome as well could be a very, very useful tool for identifying unique strategies or ways to treat those individuals.
And does that microbiome, that changes over time, though, because we're born without any bacteria, and that we start getting those immediately as soon as we're born, right? So is it a challenge to think about how that might be shifting over time? Does it change from childhood to adulthood in other places?
It does. It changes the composition of your microbiome actually stabilizes by between the ages of 1 and 2, and then you may have 5% of your microbiome being transient, i.e. bugs coming and going, but the vast majority of the species we find inside you are pretty consistent day to day. But their relative proportions change very dramatically. So that's why it's quite important to be able to if you will, sequence their microbiome before they are due in for a surgery in the hospital, or before we make a decision on a particular drug type, we could have their microbiome screened and sequenced and identified to be able to examine that. Now, currently, I want to make a very specific point. Currently, we do not have enough information to make any very specific observations or statements or prescribe any strategies based on the microbiome, but we are moving the research in that direction. And my hope is that in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll be in a much more secure place to make very predictive statements about what an individual person's microbiome might mean for their particular disease state or their particular treatment strategy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as we're thinking about that and treatment strategies, Dr. Shah, I wanted to ask you about what the status is of development of new antibiotics. Are we looking at antibiotics that will be able to kill sort of drug-resistant superbugs? Are we, as you mentioned, are we going back? I know in some cases, doctors are going back to the earliest antibiotics that we had because those original antibiotics haven't been used for some time. How are we doing on that front?
Well, while human behavior contributes to a lot of the resistance that we see, thankfully, another human endeavor, research and innovation, also provides a means for us to respond, such as you mentioned, through the development of new antibiotics. Unfortunately, the pace at which new antibiotics have been introduced has slowed quite considerably. Since 2012, there have only been 5 new antibiotics that have been approved by the FDA. Now, this slowdown isn't unique to antibiotics. It's been seen with other categories of drugs. But antibiotics are different from, say, blood pressure medications in a number of ways that affect the incentives. They often have a limited duration of treatment, a somewhat low price per dose, and, of course, as we're talking about here, the potential for the very rapid emergence of resistance that really results in some uncertain market longevity. So
is that why research has slowed then, just because it's not a great business decision, it sounds like?
I don't know. I don't want to speculate exactly why the research. I don't know if the reason for the low introductions is higher regulatory requirements or just a shallower pipeline. I think there's a lot of things going on that are affecting the pharmaceutical industry writ large, and then some particular facets that are unique to antibiotics. But all of this points to the fact that there are policy levers that can actually be put into place to speed the development. In 2012, there was some legislation passed at the federal level called the Generating Antibiotic Initiatives Law that put into place some rules at FDA to really hasten the development and approval of antibiotics, and that seems to have started to make a difference. But these are the sorts of policy responses at a national level as well as at a state level that we can and should start thinking more about to really make sure our armamentarium doesn't get depleted.
Professor Gilbert, I wonder if we could talk about prevention. We've been talking so much about the back end of treatment in terms of once someone gets sick, but I wonder what we do know about the science. There's so much marketing and materials and products out there nowadays in the whole probiotics range. And there's a lot of claims that are out there for what probiotics can do. What do we know about the science of probiotics right now?
Well, okay, so probiotics are just bacterial organisms generally, which are proven to be suggested to have beneficial effects on health, right? So you consume enough of this bug, it will improve your health. I mean, this is a very old idea. Eli Metchnikoff, a Nobel Prize laureate from the beginning of the 20th century, suggested that consuming fermented milk was one way to maintain health. What's interesting in that statement is that while we have lots of evidence that some probiotics can be very beneficial in treating disease, especially gastrointestinal sickness, so diarrhea in children, or even other diseases, everything from joint pain to IBD, what we do not have any evidence of clinically is whether the microbiome in a probiotic can be useful in treating or maintaining health, so wellness. We lack an ability to define wellness appropriately in enough people to actually be able to determine whether continuous and regular consumption of probiotics as a yogurt or in a pill form actually has any benefit. And so I argue at the moment, if any of my colleagues or friends want to take a probiotic, they do so because they feel that it might make them better, with no actual evidence that it will help them to maintain wellness. But that doesn't mean they're not effective. It just means that we don't currently have evidence to support it, or we lack the definitions of what a healthy human being actually is.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like there's specific cases where you feel like, as you mentioned, irritable bowel syndrome, diarrhea, specific cases where you feel like probiotics can help people. Dr. Shaw, from a public health standpoint, I bet people ask you all the time about probiotics. What do you think about them?
My response could have been verbatim with what Jack mentioned. Our view is that health and wellness are the keys to a great life. And if there are folks out there that feel that probiotics are the key to their health and happiness, then great. But there is also sufficient evidence that suggests that one can lead a perfectly healthy life with never ingesting a probiotic.
Professor Gilbert, I wanted to ask you about a study. There was a study a couple of years ago that showed animals with an inflamed gut that were given probiotics became less anxious. And so kind of a really interesting connection between the gut and the brain. Is there anything new on that front?
Well, there is. The evidence is still building that disruptions in how the ecosystem of your gut functions, right? Remember, it's like a rainforest in there. So if we disrupt it, then that can have effects upon how the body works. Your microbes interact with your immune system. Your microbes interact with your hormones. But your microbes also interact through chemicals with how your nervous system works, how the neurons pass signals between each other. Remember, your gastrointestinal system has its own brain, its own nervous system that's highly affected by how the bacteria are functioning, how the bacteria are consuming or generating different chemicals. So We now know that there is a lot of evidence to suggest that bacteria could be playing a role in depression and anxiety, but also in other neurodevelopmental conditions such as autism. And we're even starting to see evidence that things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's could be affected by the microbiome. And whether it's causative or that if you have Parkinson's, your microbiome changes is hard to understand at the moment. But what we do know is that when you change one thing in a system, it changes everything else. Okay, the whole body is connected, and it's connected to the microbiome. So if the body changes, the microbiome changes. That could have feedback upon the body, making the body change even more. So we think the microbiome could play a role in exacerbating symptoms. Nida, I did want to bring up one point you mentioned earlier about antibiotics, and I'd be interested in Nirav's opinion on this. You know, we talk a lot about orally administered antibiotics. So you take these antibiotics as a pill and you pop it in your intestine and, take those for 5 days and everything will be fine. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that having an injection of antibiotics, an intramuscular injection like I've had in the UK for treating an infection, can be more effective in treating the disease, as well as reducing the likelihood that you'll have a negative impact upon your gut microbes. So I wonder if there's a discussion to be had about the difference between intramuscular injection of antibiotics versus orally administered antibiotics.
Yeah, Dr. Shah, that's not maybe as, as Jack was saying, maybe that's something more common in the UK. Is that happening as much in American medicine?
Well, the clinical choice as to whether to administer an antibiotic intramuscularly through an injection or to administer it orally really depends on the patient's abilities and the degree of sickness. For a patient who's in extremis, not doing well, who probably can't tolerate swallowing, injected antibiotics or even intravenous antibiotics are indicated. Also, depending on where the infection is, an intravenous or an intramuscular antibiotic might be the way to go. So there are usually clinical factors. Now, there is some suggestion, as Jack noted in the literature, that when you give an antibiotic to someone orally, the first place it lands is in the gut, and it starts working there. And it might, because of its first route there, decimate a lot of the gut bacteria, which might be responsible for some of the effects that we see, not just with resistance, but with some of the disruptions Jack mentioned. No better of a condition is this seen in than a clinical condition that's called C. diff, which stands for Clostridium difficile. This is an infection that occurs in the colon that is often associated from healthcare settings, and it really results from excessively administered antibiotics that really decimate the gut and all of the bacteria in it, and that then leads to an overgrowth of another bacterium that can cause significant problems.
Now, Dr. Shah, I know you guys have been working in Illinois hospitals to try to reduce the incidence of C. diff. What has IDPH been doing on that?
One of the best ways to reduce C. diff is to make sure that hospitals use antibiotics appropriately, or what's called antimicrobial stewardship. These are things that have actually shown tremendous improvements in the rates of C. diff, for example, in the United Kingdom, which reduced its rate 75% since 2007. So there are a couple of components to our strategy. The first is these strict controls over when and to what extent patients in the hospital get antibiotics that have to be approved by infectious disease specialists. The second aspect is strict infection control precautions to make sure that this bug, C. diff, doesn't invade susceptible people. And then the third is environmental cleaning that tries to eliminate the spores that are actually responsible for causing it. This three-pronged strategy in other settings, for example in the UK, has been shown to reduce C. diff rates significantly. And we're already starting to see some benefits on the national level from implementing the strategy.
Interesting.
One interesting thing.
You know what? Unfortunately, Dr. Shah, we're out of time, but give me five. I could just finish your thought if you've got 10 seconds there.
One of the ways that the microbiome has been used clinically is in something called a fecal transplant, which is exactly what it sounds like, and it's actually used quite effectively in the treatment of C. diff.
We'll have to have both of you guys come back to talk about that, because we're ending on that note. Jack Gilbert, Dr. Nirav Shah, thank you both for joining us talking about antibiotics, antibiotic resistance, and the microbiome. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Governor Rauner joins a delegation of Illinois politicians in Rome celebrating the elevation of Cardinal Supich. Back in Springfield last week, lawmakers overturned two of his vetoes, and we're just 41 days from being without a state budget again. IPR's Amanda Vinicky and WUIS's Brian Mackey join us now from Springfield. Hey, guys. Amanda, Brian, welcome back to The 21st.
Hi.
Hello. Hi, Nyla.
Amanda, let's start with Governor Rauner. There's a lot of people who were in Rome this weekend at the Vatican for the elevation of Cardinal Supich. Who else was there? Mayor Rahm Emanuel, a couple other folks?
Exactly. You had plenty of, I'm sure, Catholics from Illinois that weren't part of the official delegation, but the official group led by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel was 80 people strong, and that did include the city's police superintendent. You also had the governor's first lady, I believe also one of his daughters, State Senate President John Cullerton, his wife Pam were also there. In total, according to, actually, this is the Chicago Tribune that really ran the numbers, so I give them the credit there, 24 elected officials and spouses, 13 government officials, staffers and guests, and then 9 people associated with Catholic churches and schools. That did include a pair of pretty lucky CPS students.
Yeah, well, this is a big deal for not just for obviously now Cardinal Supich, but also for the Archdiocese of Chicago and even for the American Catholic Church, because this was one of the Pope Francis's first picks for Cardinal was Blaise Supich, correct?
Exactly. And, you know, he'll have a role in any future Pope decisions going forward. And also, I think just historic, what is intriguing to me about it from an Illinois political geek perspective is, in part, that you had these personalities all together. It was a quick trip, about 4 days long. But when you travel and you share one of those experiences that can be, I think, for a lot of people, very profound, just what discussions did they have spending all of that time together? That's the question that I have. I was not there to follow along, but that is in particular, and I think Brian can speak to this, particularly because of maybe what Supich himself may have raised and stances he'd taken. Back in September of 2015, he made headlines giving a speech at a union hall.
Right. Yeah, Brian, go ahead. Because he certainly played a role, hasn't he? He hasn't been shy, now Cardinal Supich, about then when he was Archbishop, about his wading into Illinois politics and particularly the budget impasse.
Yeah, and he has spoken very strongly in favor of labor unions. The Catholic Church places a very high value on the right of people to organize on behalf of their employment situation. And of course, you know, going back a few popes to John Paul II, came from Poland, where the Solidarity Union movement helped overthrow the communist regime in that country. So there's sort of a long history of the Catholic Church supporting organized labor. And we, as Amanda pointed out, September 2015, then Archbishop Supich gave a speech in which he talked about the importance of labor at the Plumbers Union Hall in Chicago. So, of course, it's just speculation to say whether he had any conversations. I don't think I've seen any reporting, you know, with the governor about that. The governor, of course, is making a weakening of organized labor in Illinois a central part of his platform. He says that's what the Illinois economy needs to get stronger. So particularly government labor from Governor Rauner's standpoint. But yes, one can imagine that there might have been some interesting conversations.
Well, and interesting conversations to come, because certainly we've seen, I'm thinking of other arms, Catholic Charities in particular, of the Archdiocese of Chicago, one of the largest social service agencies in the Midwest, being very also vocal about the state budget impasse and how that's affecting lower income people throughout the state. So, Amanda, to your point, it is interesting to have all of these different sides together. I wonder if you can update us on last week in veto session. We saw some overturning of some of Governor Rauner's legislation he tried to veto. Can you update us on that? Let's start with automatic voter registration.
Well, and so just to be clear, it's only gone halfway through that process. Mm-hmm. So the Senate did vote to override, but it nonetheless, before it becomes law, it has to do the Both same houses. In mm-hmm. the Illinois House, mm-hmm. and it is expected to have a harder time there, just judging by a different piece of legislation and how that panned out. The House was unsuccessful in overturning a veto having to do with pay for disabled, for caretakers for the disabled. But automatic voter registration, really? I mean, that slums it up right there. Anytime that you have an interaction with government, it would update your registration or register you for the first time so people don't have to go online and do it or deal with grace period, same day election, voter registration. Illinois really has gone out of its way to make it really easy, but this makes it the easiest of all. The question that critics have is they say that this basically is a pathway to people who aren't citizens being able to vote. The governor didn't say it quite that strongly as critics have said since and on the floor. He just said it opens the door to voter fraud, and he had some concerns. Republicans tried to introduce their own version of the legislation. So basically what you have is Republicans believe that Democrats are trying to increase voter turnout, particularly ahead of the 2018 election when Rauner will be up for re-election. And then Democrats, pointing that finger right back at Republicans, say that their opposition to this legislation is just meant to stunt the vote in a still pretty blue state for that 2018 election.
And Brian, as Amanda says, it'll be interesting to see what happens next within the House with this.
Yeah, and I mean, in the House, we've seen Democrats have a much harder time overriding gubernatorial vetoes. I think it's worth pointing out here that this had pretty broad bipartisan support when it first passed in the spring. And then after the governor vetoed it, it comes back, and now suddenly a lot of Republicans are taking a second, harder look at it. And it, a lot of Republicans peeled off on this second time around. And in the House, there are far fewer Democrats. The veto-proof majority through the end of the year is only the bare minimum, and those Democrats have not always stuck together on that, and it just goes to show the power of the governor to call the shot with the Republican caucuses in the legislature.
We also saw some movement on home health care workers. Amanda Bryan, who wants to update us on that one?
Well, this is, again, another situation where it's passed the Senate because the Senate has overwhelming Democratic supermajorities, and it's going to face a much tougher road in the House. There were a number of bills, home health care workers, child care workers, that would have increased training. It would have changed the minimum wage, raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour for some of these workers. And we should add, these are people who are contracted by state government to either provide child care or provide home health care. The idea being, why does state government do this? Well, it keeps people out of nursing homes, which is theoretically much more expensive than having somebody who comes to your house for a few hours a day to help you with bathing and getting your medicine and things like that.
Amanda, as we're seeing this sort of pattern layout, and again, we're sort of in a lame duck session of State House here for the next month or so. But you expect to see this pattern continue, and then come January, I wonder how you think we're going to see politics playing out with the amount of seats that Republicans picked up in both the House and Senate in January.
January really is the interesting time, and I think what everybody has their eye out on, that's when it's actually the lame duck. You're right, the legislators are lame ducks now, but I think they're kind of more freed from the shackles of the next election at that point in time, and also a lesser number of votes is required to pass legislation and have it take effect immediately. That's why you see that further, perhaps by then, some of the bruises from the still very fresh campaign and all of the negative ads that came along with that may have gone away. So January could be the time. And further, we did see last week the governor and legislative leaders meet a couple of times, but in order to work out any deal, that's not going to happen in just a flash and a snap. So I think January is a more realistic opportunity for us to see more movement, if any. Yeah. There's a lot of questions. There could be zero, of course, but if it's going to happen, it'll be then versus really now.
Right, and before we get back to the budget, I do want to get back to that in a minute. I do want to ask about Governor Rauner. Brian, you were mentioning labor unions at the beginning of this conversation. Amanda, we saw Governor Rauner win some victories last week with the ongoing contract negotiations with AFSCME, with the municipal workers. What's going on with that?
Well, what's going on with that is really pressure by the unions, at least in the court of public opinion, I think is what they're trying to bring Governor Bruce Rauner back to the bargaining table. I don't think that the governor has given any indication that he is ready or willing to do that. He has a pretty big victory from the State Labor Relations Board. With its decision, he can implement the, quote, last best offer, the offer that union members are protesting against because they say that it opens the door to subcontracting, people basically replacing their positions with those who aren't part of a labor union, and then also a wage freeze, they have to work longer before overtime kicks in, and a pretty big increase in their health care expenses. That's all things that Rauner sees as wins. That's clearly part of his overarching argument for weakening labor. At least that's how unions see it. And further, he says that's a big savings to taxpayers. The real only questions from here on out are, as labor seeks to take this to court, will that change anything? You know, will the judicial branch get involved and somehow change what goes forward? Or are unions left with the choice of striking?
And all of this comes back to, and Brian, I'd love to have you weigh in here, Governor Rauner and the budget impasse tied to his turnaround agenda, which is, as you said, labor has been a key part of that, limiting organizing and other abilities for public unionized workers. So as we're seeing progression on that front through the courts, Brian, I wonder how much, and Amanda, if you can finish by weighing in as well, how we see all of these pieces fitting together. The turnaround agenda with the budget. But this is like our big question, right, as we're looking at our budget expiring, the stopgap budget expiring on December 31st.
I think that you have to understand that one of the governor's key goals coming into office is reducing the costs of what he says is what he calls the bureaucracy, right? The cost of personnel in government is one of the biggest expenses that Illinois has. Prison guards, state police officers, people like that. And I think he thinks that you can save billions of dollars and circumvent future tax increases and begin to bend the cost curve of pensions, which we heard last week are at $130 billion is going to be our future projected deficit for the Illinois government pension system. And you have to look at this as a larger picture. He has there's a court case out of California that was kind of put on hold last year after Justice Scalia passed away. The U.S. Supreme Court couldn't take it, but this could undermine the fee structure for government employee unions across the country. And so I think you have, with the election of President Trump presumably appointing a conservative to fill that seat, that's something that could eventually cascade down and really hurt the fundraising structure for government employee unions here in Illinois. This is all part of a bigger picture. I think the governor is succeeding in this way, and he doesn't even have to go through the legislature to do it, particularly in terms of the contract that he is moving to impose on state workers.
Amanda, we just have about less than a minute left, but I just wonder what you think of what we need to look for in the next coming weeks for movement on passing another budget.
See if the governor and leaders do, in fact, get together again. They said that they were going to, but nothing was scheduled, in part because of the Rome trip and the Thanksgiving holiday. But we, I think, just should be keeping an eye on their interactions, if there are, in fact, any at all.
That's IPR's Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief, WUIS's Brian Mackey, both of them on the line from Springfield. Brian, Amanda, thanks so much for being with me.
My pleasure.
Happy to be here.
Have a great Thanksgiving, too, guys.
You too, Nyla. Happy mashed potatoes and turkey.
And speaking of which, that's all the time we have for today. But tomorrow, if you're worried about discussing politics over the Thanksgiving table, we're going to be talking about how to navigate that tricky terrain on tomorrow's program. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us, whether it's phone, email, or social media, is at our website, 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter. If you search for 21ST Show, we live tweet during the show with more analysis and background on what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, if you search for the 21st to like us there, you can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We've got a post up about the difficult Thanksgiving conversation. So if you're looking for advice, you can post there. We're produced by Howla Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.